Hey guys, this episode of the Dark Girl Talk is with Eva Bertelsson as our guest. We'll talk about seamless session and what it means and how to react when an error happens. Stay with us and listen.
Thank you again for agreeing for this conversation. I'm really happy to have you. And our topic today, it's a seamless session, training session. Is it even possible to talk about some kind of a recipe or formula for a training session, no matter what sport you do, no matter what activity you do with your dog? Because often people are so much into a specific sport that they think that if they do agility, then they may not really learn a lot and they cannot combine. It's absolutely a different activity than, for example, obedience. Yeah. So do we have a common ground and points we can include to make a session, training session, as seamless and fluent as possible?
I think this is where it's really beneficial to think about behavior in terms of the situation before the behavior we're looking for, and what comes next. Because the behavior and our reinforcers, that's going to be our cues, our behaviors, our reinforcers. The concepts are similar, or the concepts are the same, no matter what the venue is. So the behavior might be totally different, mm-hmm. and the cue might be totally different, and I might be using a totally different reinforcer. Mm-hmm. It may be that in my agility, the setup is that I am tugging with my dog and then turning toward the tunnel, and I ask her to let go of the tunnel while I'm moving. And the behavior might be her rushing through the tunnel. Mm-hmm. And the reinforcer may be me throwing her toy in the direction my handling is going, okay. so that she can grab that toy as she comes out of the tunnel following my direction. That would be seamless to me, and that would be an example mm-hmm. with the setup and the cues, the behavior and the reinforcer sort of coming all in a flow.
Okay.
And if I do the same thing, say in working with my obedience come to heel.
Yeah.
Well, maybe then the starting point is me leaving her in a sit stay and walking away from her, and then standing very still, giving her just a verbal cue. Mm-hmm. And the behavior is her rushing to me and coming into heel position, which doesn't look anything like going through a tunnel, yeah. but it can still be seamless.
Absolutely.
And the reward might be me clicking and giving her a treat.
Okay.
And that doesn't look anything like me throwing a ball after a tunnel, but it's still something that happens contingent on her behavior and without any gaps in between.
Okay, so to talk about seamless session, we need to find antecedents and actually consequences used for behavior, and to set up this training in a way that there are no gaps in between each of it, because otherwise, and it doesn't matter if it's a tunnel or if it's a heel position, you still have a clear beginning when the behavior starts and then a consequence. So we can find like what we need to do to make it really fluent. And these are observable things, actually.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. And it's things that we do. Mm-hmm. It's me doing things as a handler, as a trainer. And it's my dog, my learner, doing things. And mm-hmm. these things sort of interacting. So when we see seamlessness, that's when it's a predictable flow. I do something, she mm-hmm. does something, I respond predictably, and she responds to that. And it's all sort of going, it's like a ping pong game going back and forth. But instead of one of us trying to outmaneuver the other one, mm-hmm. we're sort of really playing a game where the ball just flows back and forth, really.
Okay. Oh, that's a great one. can we think about a scenario that we need to incorporate into the session that may help us create this flow? I mean, can we, when we go to a training session, we need to think about how we will start the behavior and how we will reinforce it, because otherwise we can do this, in the while we're working already. We need to have it planned, otherwise it's practically impossible, because this ball will fall from the table.
Exactly. So having a set set starting point in a way is one of the things that are really, really a necessity in order for this seamlessness to be possible. It's interesting. When Emily, my colleague, and I started discussing seamlessness, we came to the conclusion that the one thing that we can always start with, no matter what the session looks like, is the end of the previous reward. So start with the reward procedure. Start with where your dog is eating a treat or playing with a toy or running after the ball that you just threw. That's one possibility for where you can start. So if I'm just sitting in my sofa and I just want to start a training session, that's one way that I can start. Just offer a freebie reward, and as I deliver that reinforcer, I can start my session from there. That's one of the possibilities that I also use if I'm working with an animal that I'm working with in protected contact. Like currently I'm working with cats in a cat shelter. Yeah. And the start of the training session would be me coming up to the outside of the fence and just offering a treat. And if my cat comes over and takes that treat, her taking the treat, that will start the session. So that's one possibility.
Yeah. And this is the way you deliver this first treat is a start for the behavior that animal is about to offer. And is this seamlessness only discussed in terms of behaviors that are already somehow developed or in the maintenance phase, or the seamlessness can be incorporated into like teaching from the scratch? Or is it impossible because we don't know how the animal will respond to what we do?
So in order to establish this seamlessness from scratch, one easy way of doing it is just do a session where the only thing happening is one reinforcer followed by another one, followed by another one. Okay. So with the cats, maybe I come up and I offer a treat and another treat and another treat. And after the cat just eating five treats, the final treat I make into a more long lasting one that the cat can play around with for a while or be busy with for a while. And then I leave. Because then I have a session already. I don't have much behavior. But if my cat is staying with me and eating five treats, then we will start to see behavior happen in between those treats. And then in the next session, I can start introduce some gaps in between the treats.
Because you know how the animal will behave.
Yes, exactly.
That's great. So we can start with easy stuff. I mean, we can start with feeding, actually, with just delivering the treat. And it's nothing wrong, because what I see is that often people consider this against the shaping rules, that you need to just sit there and wait for animal to solve your idea for a training session. And it's not what it's about, right? Shaping. It's actually more about creating the possibility for the behavior to happen, and the behavior you want actually to happen, not the stuff, all the stuff in between, right?
I totally agree. I want my shaping sessions to go as smoothly as possible for my learner, and I can set that up by, in the beginning, just building this expectancy behaviors in a way of another treat is coming, another treat is coming.
Okay.
And in the same time, you will establish some kind of base position. What do I do as a cat or a dog? What does the learner do in between each treat? It's interesting how it's come about that shaping has the notion of shaping being this thing where you sit around waiting for a very long time. It's good shaping never looked like that.
Yes, but I think this is a very popular concept that it's like, at least recently I was going through many articles on the internet about shaping in Poland, and most of them were describing shaping as waiting for the learner to offer behaviors and picking out of these behaviors the ones you like, and just putting on extinction the ones you don't like, which can be tricky.
And I agree if we do it on a very small scale. I think people are just not very used maybe to looking at behavior, like looking at all the behavior that happens. Because even if I give my cat a treat and then I give her another treat and then I give her another treat, and then the next session I give her a treat and I look for the behavior of her looking up toward where treats usually come from. Yeah. And then I deliver the next treat. That's still going to be me looking at a specific response. So I am waiting
for maybe
I'm waiting for a split second. I'm not waiting for 5 minutes, but I'm still waiting. I'm just waiting small.
Yeah.
And I'm reinforcing a specific response and I'm not reinforcing something else. Mm-hmm. It's just smaller scale.
And it's not, maybe the problem is sometimes mixing capturing and shaping. Yeah. So it's like you actually not with capturing, you're not teaching, you're just taking the behavior that already is there. And with shaping, we need to have those small, tiny approximations, especially if we think about not the result, but also how the behavior is performed. So not just the final product, but the whole process and action and movement. And this is, I think, where we often get mixed up, and we are waiting for full behavior for the first session. We're waiting for this full behavior to happen. And then we have a lot of frustration on the other hand, because it's difficult when animal doesn't know what we want to just come up with this very, for example, with a heel position, if we try to shape it.
And that's like the whole idea, the concept of shaping is about the successive approximation. That's like, by definition, the opposite or a totally different thing from us waiting around for a full thing to happen that's never happened before. The whole idea of shaping is that we use those small approximations and build on them.
Okay, so when we want to incorporate the, for example, teaching a new behavior from the scratch into a seamless session, we should first consider how we're going to deliver the first treat and how we can get the behavior, the first small approximation.
Yeah.
And we can.
And that's where I think it's really valuable for people to learn about shaping and to do a lot of shaping, because you end up learning some creative ways of where can you start. Yeah. Often we have to go way back in order to start a shaping session. Say you're working on backing up.
Yeah.
Well, what's the first thing in a shaping session having to do with backing up? Well, it's your learner being in a decent position to begin with. If your learner is 5 meters away, or if your learner is laying on her back, it's not a good starting point. So really, like, starting, it's nowhere near clicking and treating for backward motion or weight shift or anything like that. It's way, way before that. That we need to start.
So with a base position somehow.
Yeah.
So we need to, and the base position can be different for different behavior we want. Like for backing, we don't want a dog laying down, and for rolling upside down, we don't want a dog standing.
Exactly. And that's part of the shaping process going into the behavior to get that.
So the shaping is not about just creating a behavior from the most difficult starting position.
Exactly. It's about getting that the starting position that you need in the first place. Can I add on the how we start the session?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a super important one.
Expand one step further on that.
Yeah.
Because say we now have our dog that's, well, we started with a freebie treat, and mm-hmm. then I'm starting to shape coming in front of me or delivering my treat so that my learner is in front of me so that we can start backing up.
Yeah.
An even better way to, so that I can also take a break, would be to add a station of some kind.
Okay.
So that we can also take frequent breaks mm-hmm. without getting garbage behavior in between.
And confusion from the dog's part. Right?
And confusion. So some kind of pause activity
mm-hmm.
that might be having a station of some kind, a crate, a table, a mat.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
that also becomes so important for the handler mm-hmm. because then the handler sort of knows when am I working with my dog in a training session and when can I think and plan and discuss with the other people around me.
And this is something really important because very often we can see people just not knowing what to do, especially in seminars, when they want to discuss something they just have done with the dog and they start talking, which is a natural thing for us to do. If we want to ask something, we just and don't know what to do with our dog, we just leave the dog and start talking to the instructor. And we are teaching our dog that this connection, this engagement, and leaving him alone is a normal thing, and that he is not really confident with our behavior because we are not predictable. Because sometimes we just work, and then suddenly stop and start talking to someone else. It's like right now I would just start talking to my dog next to me instead of you, just without any notice. Just right now I would just say, oh God, like, how are you? And just, you know, pay attention to him and just not tell you that maybe something happened and let you know that right now I need to take a break because I don't know, something happened to him and I need to take care of it. And so I would just like disconnect completely.
And that becomes especially important perhaps if we're looking at shaping sessions where we want our learners to offer behavior. Because if we check out and they offer behavior that we don't provide and reinforcers for, mm-hmm. then we're going to extinguish those behaviors.
Yeah. And on the other hand, we may reinforce the garbage behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
So if we don't have those clear training moments and break moments.
Yeah, that would be my dog whining or bouncing up and down or barking to the other direction, or the cat scratching the door, or typical, you know, with the horses banging the door in the stable or scratching their foot.
It's extinction.
It's extinction. And it can easily become behavior that's reinforced, and then it's not even an extinction behavior anymore. Then it's just a behavior that you do to get your human started again.
Because they usually start, like in the seminar, we leave the dog, not telling him it's a break. We start talking to the instructor. The dog starts to bark or jump on us. And then we turn to him saying, let's say, be quiet, or now it's a break, or whatever. And we keep talking and the situation repeats. And finally, we go back to work. So we finally reinforce all the garbage behavior we receive from our dog. And this will become a part of a training session. It can be like a pattern, right?
Yes, quickly, for both of us.
For both of us, okay.
And of course, in a sense, mm-hmm. well, that could be part of your very seamless session. It's just usually not the kind of seamlessness that trainers are looking for.
Oh, absolutely.
But it can be a very integrated and sort of very fluent part of the training. It's just maybe not as planned.
Okay, so we can, like, seamlessness, it's about predictability. And about, like, both ways, right? Can we see that?
I think so. Because it's about me cueing off my dog and my dog cueing off me. Me cueing off my dog to deliver reinforcers, and cueing off my dog to deliver the next cue, and my dog cueing off me for what behavior to do or what reinforcer to go for.
Okay.
And the gaps, the garbage behaviors, mm-hmm. they typically come in there if my dog isn't reaching the reinforcer in a
mm-hmm.
in a reasonably predictable way.
Okay. Or if he doesn't, yeah, if he doesn't know what to do, right?
Yeah.
If it's some, there is some lack of clarity.
Yeah. Either there is a reinforcer that should be there that hasn't arrived, or mm-hmm. there is a cue that should be there that hasn't arrived, and the dog is sort of left in limbo. Yeah.
But can we, I was thinking about this and talked to someone about the brakes and the mat or crate or whatever. Mm-hmm. Is it like adding those brakes, those stationary brakes, is it not taking away a little bit of choice? This was the person that asked me, mm-hmm. it was the question. So that like, we don't give the animal a real break because it's still like a task to do, right? Stay on a mat or go to a crate. And then we like release him from this break and continue work. But is it like taking away a little bit of the choice by making him do the behavior during the break?
I think that's a really good question. And it's partly, it's a matter of, will I be available all the time? Mm-hmm. If I want to have like as much choice available as possible for my dog, mm-hmm. I would like for her to be able to tell me when to start and when to stop. And mm-hmm. I would also have her tell me what to do.
Okay.
But if I need to think in the break to sort of set the next criteria,
mm-hmm.
will I then be available to respond to her?
Okay.
If I can be that, if I can, mm-hmm. if I can be available to respond to her,
mm-hmm.
Then we could have like play breaks or lay on the floor, hang out breaks,
mm-hmm.
where we just, it's not a break where she goes to her mat and I sit down and think.
Yep.
It's a break where we just hang out together. And that's a lovely type of break. And mm-hmm. during that break, when I am 100% focused on her all the time,
mm-hmm.
then she can sort of cue me to say, okay, now we've played enough. We've been hanging out on the grass enough. Let's go back to training now.
But if I
need to take a break in my head, I need to check out to know what to do next. Then I think it becomes more fair to my dog. To give her information that says that I'm not available right now. Other things are available, but I'm not as available.
That's great. And I think we can do both, right?
Yeah.
And yes, depending totally. On what we can do at this particular moment.
Yeah.
And I just want to go back for a moment to the beginning of this session. And mm-hmm. concept of choice. It's like if you start with a treat, right, and offering a treat to an animal, how can you tell that you are giving a choice for the animal to start training interaction with you?
So choice always requires experience, mm-hmm. right? There is no way we can choose something to do it or to stay away from it if we don't have experience from it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's I absolutely can see a valid point in that if I start every training session in the same way,
mm-hmm.
say the training session always start with my dog coming out of the crate, me giving her a treat in front of me, and then when that treat ends, the training session starts. She cannot know
mm-hmm.
what type of session we're gonna do.
Mm-hmm.
So if I want to give her more information so that I can ask her, would you like to do a training session with the agility tunnel, or would you like to do a training session with the obedience come to heal?
Mm-hmm.
Then I would have to set up, it's almost like setting up an experiment. where she would have to get experience with both contingencies, and they would have to start differently. And I would have to sort of add in some kind of choice behavior in the beginning. So I guess it could look like her being in her crate and me having both possibilities behind me. So there is a tunnel to my right and there is the obedience area to my left. And I would stand still and ask her, okay, which one? And she could then run out to either one of them. And then I would give her the starting treat out there and start working with a session that she indicated.
Okay, well, that's a that's actually a good option to check what our animal is really enjoying. It's like what preferences they have.
Yes, yes. And it does, testing preferences, it really does require that we set it up so that we are sure that our learner gets experience from the different choices. Because sometimes I think if I put out my two hands with one treat in my left hand and a toy in my right hand and just see which one my dog goes for, is that her preference, or is that how she has learned to act?
Okay.
Because you might, I could have a dog that really loves the toy, but that has some previous training of only going for the toy on cue, not grabbing the toy. And then that dog would go for the treat. Not because it prefers it, but because it's learned that in order to get the toy, you have to
eat the treat.
Sort of stay away from it first.
Yeah. So it's a different a cue actually for the behavior, for different behavior, and then it's not a choice. Absolutely. So can we introduce because often I see people asking about can they teach the dog to choose interaction with them? And I think very often it's confusing because what I see sometimes is that either you stay in the crate and have no interaction whatsoever with other dogs, or you are not going anywhere, or you work with me. And can we talk about choice in this setup?
Well, for me, I would say it is a choice between those two very things that you just described. It's like that a choice is going to be between the available contingencies that you have experience from. So if those are if the choice is between stay in the crate, no interaction whatsoever, or come out play with me.
Yeah.
Well, it is choice. It's choice between those options. It's not choice of any other option. It's not the dog choosing to work with me rather than playing with the other dogs.
Yeah.
It's the dog choosing to work with me rather than being in the crate. It's choice, but it's a choice between those options.
So a very limited choice.
Yeah. And I guess that's like when talking to more traditional trainers about recall.
Yeah.
And they'd say, well, my dog is not going to be interested in a meatball if he can go swim in the lake.
Yeah.
He's not going to choose meatball over swim in the lake. And in a training setup, I would set up the training so that the dog gets so much reinforcement history for the coming eat meatball, and maybe also some reinforcement history of coming eat meatball, go swim in the lake.
Okay.
And I would simultaneously limit the access to the lake.
So that
choice is not available. So I would actually set up a very limited choice. It's not going to be a choice between coming to me, eating a meatball, or going to the lake by yourself, because going to the lake by yourself is not going to be accessible. Going to the lake will only be accessible through me. That's where teaching.
Oh, you froze. And do you hear me? I can see you, but you're frozen. My connection, I think it's good.
You are still moving.
Okay.
And yeah, I see. Now you froze and you're back. It's very predictable. It's a predictable pattern. I freeze, then you freeze, and then, we're back.
Okay, good. Now it's all back to normal. Okay, so going back to what you said, it's not wrong to limit choices. And because this is actually making a dog more successful in terms of choosing. Like, if you want to have a successful recall, you don't choose your first session in the most disturbing and challenging environment.
Exactly.
Because your dog won't be successful.
So we want to give our learners a lot of choice, but we also want to be aware of when we are limit choices and why we're doing so.
Okay. Yeah, and it's not all bad, but because many people are sometimes struggling with dogs that are not coming to them if they start a training session, and they take all the things they usually have for a training session, so if it's obedience, for example, a dumbbell or whatever, and then the dog is just staying away until being cued to come.
Mm-hmm.
The dog is not any nearby you unless you cue him, you know, it's time to work now. We're going to work now. And the dog otherwise will not come, will just choose to sniff the grass or lay down in the sun. It's no choice here, right? Or is it a choice? Because if we cue the dog and the dog doesn't come, we can allow the dog to stay and do what he wants to do. Mm-hmm. But what if we cue the dog and the dog comes because he knows there is a reinforcement available from us, but still this was not his decision to make in terms of like, I want to engage in a training session. I would rather just take your treat and go back and sniff the grass.
Mm-hmm.
Can we
see? And I can see that it could be like two different histories behind this. There could be the history of, I'm going to hang back here, but I have learned that other things in life become unavailable when I hear my recall cue. Mm-hmm. So I know I'm going to get a treat, but I also know that I'm not going to have access to go sniff in the ground or go do something else when I hear that recall. And that's sort of why the dog is coming. Mm-hmm. It might also be that the dog has learned that staying away is what gets you to start the training session. So it may be that the cue is really valuable. The cue is, yay, finally the training session is started. But the dog has not got any history of him sort of being active in a way that we would immediately understand to start the training session. But he might be engaging, but by staying away. Like, I go over here and that's sort of my station, my starting point. That's, if I do this, that's what gets the training session started.
Okay.
And so we sort of need to look at the history that goes behind that behavior to know, is it that the dog is laying under the table because there is a history of him getting the recall so that you can get started? Okay. Or is it that he's laying under the table because he enjoys laying under the table?
Okay.
And would rather be just hanging out under the table.
Okay, so is it, say, talking about the starting point, is it good, is it beneficial for a seamless training session to have always the same starting procedure?
I think it's got to be it depends question here, because since the seamlessness is going to look different in different venues and different locations, I don't think it would be practical to have the exact same starting routine. I also think that it's easier for me to read my dog's preferences if I don't have the exact same starting procedures. So the more information I can give my learner early on in the session about where we're going with the session, the easier it's going to be for me to see both his preferences in engaging in that activity. And it's also going to be a bit more likely that he will offer the behaviors that I'm looking for if he can sort of tell the difference a little bit more from the very beginning. So my start of an agility training session where I want to work with shaping in a way where my dog moves away from me, my start would probably look a bit different compared to if I'm working in an obedience session where I want my dog's default to be to sort of cue, turn in toward me.
Okay, but would you say it's like the first moment, not even the first treat or the first behavior you start, but the routine from going like, from the crate? It's like, you know, you come to a training session, and for obedience, do you do it differently when your dog is in the crate in the car, for example? And then you go to a training facility, and would you do this road between the car crate and the training venue and the first moment you start out there differently than you do with agility?
Good question. I really don't know. Okay. I think I do have differences. I don't think they are necessarily thought through. Okay. I think my differences might come from what the typical venues look like, what are the things I would typically bring, what are the warm-up procedures that I typically would do, like physically with my dog. So I think there will be some differences, but not really thought through from a seamlessness perspective. I will make sure that there is like seamlessness all the way from the car. Even if there is integrated just relax time, let's go sniff, hang out, greet friends, that's still going to happen in sort of a predictable manner, so that there is no garbage behavior creeping in there. But I think that's more my focus on the seamlessness when it comes from this to the steps.
Okay.
Going from the car into the venue is more about, is there predictability and is there a reasonable setup where my dog can be successful without, without, again, garbage behavior, behavior that I later want to erase.
Extinguish, right?
or just do with a totally different plan. Where they don't happen in the first place.
That's absolutely.
You realize afterwards that it was a crappy idea to park nearby the kindergarten where the dog got really worried about all the 50 kids running and screaming. And that sort of set a really lousy starting point for your training session and was not beneficial for the dog whatsoever in any sense. Well, that sort of interrupts the seamlessness.
Absolutely.
And that's something I can avoid by just thinking more cleverly when I park my car. Okay. So I want to erase that behavior from the map, but I'm not going to work on it in that setting. I'm just going to choose a different parking spot.
Oh, absolutely. So back to seamlessness. It's all about having the clarity, having the predictability, having the ability to control the setting, the environment, in a way that allows your dog to be successful and offer only behaviors you want.
Yeah. And that would be behavior I want, and I would make sure that my choices of behavior are behaviors that are also beneficial for my dog. So in behaviors is like it's included the experience that the dog is having. So it's not just dog walking politely past the kids. It's also the kids not being a stimulus that's aversive to my dog.
Okay. And would you say that in those seamlessness, we still, even if we just don't release the dog to go what he wants on the breaks, and just if he's ready returning to us, we are still looking for behavior changes that may indicate our dog is not really willing to continue the session, and like it's still limited by a choice, that our dog is showing us that he would rather choose something else to do instead of staying in the situation. But if we don't respond, he will stay because of the history of reinforcement and all the session and setup.
Yeah. So having sessions, having a session structure where you can observe your dog and where you can respond sort of accordingly becomes an important part of it. So it doesn't have to be, and it shouldn't be seamless just from your perspective. It should also be that there is a seamlessness in sense of my dog being able to communicate to me, or me being responsive to my dog. So it really should be both ways. And I think that's an important aspect to sort of think of when we structure our training sessions, that it's partly how should I set up this structure? That's like one layer. Yeah. How should I set up the structure to be likely to get the behavior I'm looking for, or the behaviors I'm looking for? And then the other layer would be, how do I set up this structure so that my dog can opt in and opt out?
Okay.
And this, that's like crucial. Just another layer. And it can be behaviors that my dog has very clear experience of using, so that he can sort of talk to me clearly. But it should also be me paying attention to more subtle motions that may indicate some discomfort or some opting out, sort of would opt out if he had the language.
Oh yeah, so we don't want to wait for, it's like Chirac said, we don't want animals to scream, we want to listen them whisper. So we are not really waiting for our dog to completely disengage and choose to go sniff the grass. We want to prevent it during the session. And seamlessness is about what you said right now. It's about also being responsive to our animal. It's not like just I wrote down those 5 points I'm going to do during the session and how I'm going to move my dog. It's also about what will I do if something goes not exactly as I planned it, and not sticking to the plan no matter what.
Yeah. And making sure that the, just as you said, making sure that the plan has those exit routes that they are in the plan. Okay. If I see any sign of discomfort, then I do X.
Yeah. Okay. So we don't, it's nothing really wrong with just finishing a training session if we see that we are just losing everything. It's better to just toss treats and think about another session later.
In general, a very good idea. And there is no way we can erase time anyway. It's one of Emily's, my colleague's favorite sayings, that you cannot go back. There's no way. We have to keep going forward to the next second. We cannot back up time.
Absolutely.
We just cannot. And therefore, trying to fix something, you know, those desperate, oh, let me just continue working with this for 2 more minutes. We can fix it. Well, if it's broken already, maybe you can make it look better than it did, but it's not going to be fixed because it's already happened.
Yes. And it
might as well take a break continue working on it when you have all your faculties together.
Absolutely. It's like doing something because something went wrong and just trying to make it better never really ends well. It's not the best idea.
Okay. I think there's some kind of desperation in there coming from, with other things that we do physically, we can often fix it.
Yeah.
If you are building a sand, you're a little kid and you're building a sand castle and you make a mistake, so it sort of falls over. Mm-hmm. You can fix it. You can rebuild it. And the people coming to look at it will never know it was once broken because you fixed it. It's just that with behavior, every experience counts. The sandcastle doesn't remember that it once fell apart and then later it stood up. It's just a sandcastle. But your dog and his learning history, the learning history will always be there. It's no way we can erase it. And we might as well wait and keep building on it later.
Wow, this was brilliant. I mean, the example, because this is what people do, and this is such a great explanation why they do it. And yeah, we just need to realize it, that yeah, it's not a sandcastle, but this is really, like, talking to me, this example was really, really great. Cool. Yeah, it was perfect.
And I always think it's so fascinating to try to look at the behavior history of us, of the people. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes we do really stubborn and sort of weird things, like trying to fix stuff in a training session that's not just really meaningful. Mm-hmm. And it's like, there are good reasons we do things in other aspects of our lives that work like that.
Yes, and we're just trying to, this is extinction, maybe, that it doesn't work, what was bringing us reinforcement. Yeah. So we go.
So I work harder.
Yeah, I work harder, and I go back to things that brought me reinforcement, which is trying harder or trying differently, maybe, and mm-hmm. trying desperately to earn this reinforcement. And reinforcement being our dog performing a behavior in a way we want.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so, and that's also that leads also to where you would do things to get the behavior to happen so that it looks the way you want.
Oh, yes.
That's where all the inadvertent prompts or lures or
pushes
or pressure comes in. Just because the reinforcer is the behavior looking nicely. Not necessarily the dog learning, just seeing that sit or that jump or whatever, just seeing it happen is so reinforcing. So we try everything in the book to just make it happen.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, it's completely like this. We want the result in this moment. It doesn't matter what's the process. It doesn't matter what is actually happening. If we just see this one repetition of the behavior we want, we can finish.
Yeah, it's kind of, I think we do a lot of things in desperation.
Oh, definitely, yes, we do. And this is all behavior, actually. It's not something mentalistic here. It's absolutely behavior.
It's a lot of reinforcement history for doing that. It's just, it doesn't work so well when we have to do with our other living being learner.
Exactly, because we actually can get this behavior. I mean, the final product, not maybe it's not even not this behavior we wanted in the first place, but this final product, we are often successful with pressure, with even a little bit of correction sometimes, because even inadvertently used correction by pressure, or sometimes just pushing the dog to just one little step ahead from the final product. So we will try, and this works, unfortunately. Yeah. This works for us in this particular moment. Maybe later in the next session, we will work through a lot of stuff that is the result of this. But for now, it works. And we look for
that. And it doesn't, often it's not even a thought through decision. Mm-hmm. It's just what your body does.
Yes.
In that session. And maybe you look at the video later and you're like, oh no, I did it again. I'm not supposed to do that.
Why have I done this? Absolutely. Yeah. Okay.
And I guess it comes directly to us working for immediate reinforcers better than we do for more delayed ones. So the immediate reinforcer is just seeing the behavior happen. And the more delayed reinforcer is it going to be a stable behavior that appears predictably in the future? Well, that comes later. Just seeing the thing now.
So we are just like every animal.
Totally.
So it's not something, this is what we want to teach our dogs sometimes, but we have to teach ourselves also that it's not about now. It's learning is a process. So
yes,
it's not now. Okay, exactly. Thank you so much, because I think we need to finish. So thank you so much for this conversation. I had really great time. And
oh, thank you. Very, very, very interesting discussion. Lovely.
Okay, thank you so much. I hope that you will agree, maybe with Emily, if she agrees to, one day to have another conversation with me.
Yes.
This would be great. And especially before maybe our event in Poland.
Looking forward to it.
In the next episode, I had the pleasure to talk with Corey Robertson, BCBA from Florida Institute of Technology. The next episode will be ready in a few weeks, so stay with us and subscribe.